What we will be doing, since yesterday was more of a summary from all of the different work that's been done over the past 3 months and the synthesis of all that work into the communique. This morning we'll be looking at some other perspectives, and we'll be looking at these other perspectives in kind of two different kind of media. One will be that we will have a panel shortly, in about 10 minutes, with the topic Ontology for Big Systems, Promises and Challenges. And I'll go over the questions that we'll have. This will be an old-fashioned panel where we will ask the panelists different kinds of questions related to ontology and big systems, and we'll then open it up for discussion with the entire forum. We'll have a break, and then after the break, what we'll be doing is having a demo session where we have, I think we have about six different demonstrations. Some of these will be live in the room, some will be done remotely, and some will be done by video. So kind of a multimedia presentation and from many different perspectives. And they all kind of tie in one way or another with not only this year's summit topic, but actually some of them kind of bring together previous summit topics in the light of this year's topic of ontology and big systems. After the demos, Wendy Wiegand, is Wendy here yet? Later? Okay, excellent. So Wendy will be giving a little bit of a mini keynote on the big data challenge at NITRD. And then we'll start a bit of general discussion on the panel, communique, just anything that's come up in the morning, anything from the demos. We want to have some time for discussion. One of the big benefits of having the symposium and is having everyone not here in the room, people virtually, and being able to just brainstorm on other kinds of topics that might have come up. So we'll be kind of allowing some time there. We'll also have a little bit of wiggle room. If some of the demos go a teensy bit over, we'll kind of take some time out of that general discussion. We'll have lunch at 12:45 again, and after lunch, we will have the presentation of the communique by Todd and Ali. And following the afternoon break, we will have the affirmation of the community by the community, and we'll be talking about that, what that's all about after lunch. Are there any questions about this morning's schedule? Okay, Leo, if you had a few comments. I'm not sure if Nicole is online.
He wasn't, yeah.
Yeah, he wasn't.
Welcome, folks, to the second day. I have no prepared remarks. Again, we'd like to, Nicole and I, Nicole unfortunately cannot attend, but he should be on the chat line here shortly. But we'd like to thank Model Driven Solutions for our refreshments for today. I'll underscore Michael's remarks that we made great progress yesterday and last night and maybe this morning on the communique. So I think that I hope you have an enjoyable morning with the kind of change of pace. We have a panel this year. We've had a panel in the past, but we also have a set of demos, which I think you'll find interesting. So welcome and enjoy.
Thank you.
So I guess any other comments? Rom, did you want to make any?
Only towards the end.
Towards the end?
The only thing I would like to say is that Todd and Ali really worked a lot at the 8 o'clock, and they made sure that I stayed here at the 8 o'clock and got my work done too.
Well, in that regard, I want to thank Rom for being an excellent host, providing us with food and drink, and a very fancy conference room to work in.
Okay. Well, I guess what we have 5 minutes before the panel starts, but I think I could invite the panelists now, and I'll go through some introductions. Just come on up. Everyone, come on up. We
have the seats here. No special seating assignments.
So as Leo said, in previous symposia, we have had panels. And I said what I wanted to have this year was a kind of a very interactive sort of panel and panel experience. To begin the introductions, let's see, I guess stage left here, we have Lynn Pouchard from Oak Ridge National Laboratory. Next to Lynn, we have George Strawn, NCO NITRD. And over on stage right, we have Olivier Bodenreiter from, actually it's NLM, right? National Library of Medicine. Okay. It's a subset or part of? Part of. So we have to use myriology ontology to capture that. Okay. and also participating remotely, Paul Hoffman from Safran Technology, formerly from SAP. He will be participating remotely from Palo Alto. I'm not sure if he's online quite yet. Okay. Okay, well. So the format for the panel, and this is, again, really kind of panel-led discussion. Through all the different sessions that we have had over the past 3 months, and all the different, from all the different, not only the sessions themselves and the virtual panelists that were presenting in those meetings, a lot of other questions arise in the chat. As people have kind of noticed even yesterday, we kind of treat the chat as this nice archive of questions that sometimes maybe don't get answered or completely addressed during a particular virtual session or even a session like this yesterday. And so what we did was kind of scraped some questions, some of the outstanding questions from these the forums over the past 3 months. And we thought these would provide a nice sort of general overview. Since these were some of the unresolved questions from the different sessions, this might be a nice opportunity to really maybe tackle these in the light of the experiences that we've had over the past 3 months. And so what we have are these six questions here. Just to kind of go over them briefly. One is, we want to know, why are ontologies important? I mean, this is kind of a question that was actually in some ways part of the motivation for last year's summit, making the case for ontologies, making the business case for ontologies was last year's summit topic. And so we want to kind of get some sense of, in the big systems arena, why are ontologies important? Another question is, well, how do we kind of measure success? So what are the different metrics, success metrics that we have from the application of ontologies? Have there been improvements kind of in some kind of quantitative way, or are there qualitative improvements, things that couldn't be done before that can be done now, again, in the context of big systems? How does the work that people are doing fit into the big data picture? So in the context of the panelists and also everyone in the room, what is the nature of the big data problem that you're facing, and what role do ontologies play in that picture? What are some of the exciting initiatives that people are seeing right now? Who should we be watching, and what are we looking for in those different initiatives? Kind of a standard question, I guess, is always, what's the killer app that we're hoping to see emerge over the next few years? So putting on our prognosticator hats and trying to anticipate the future. And then finally, why are ontologies essential for modeling systems? So what's the big kind of, well, not benefit, because that's kind of, I guess, addressing question number one, but are there, again, certain qualitative new things that we can do with ontologies in the context of big data? And let's try to kind of address what some of those are.
Mike, yes? Could you ask if
someone from this area? Okay. Paul, are you online?
Yes, I'm online. Can you hear me?
Excellent. Welcome.
Thank you. Hello from California. The sun is just rising up here.
Thank you very much for getting up very early, I guess particularly after a busy travel schedule. So welcome to the symposium.
And thank you for inviting me, Mike.
I just finished introducing the other three panelists, and so I'll just introduce you. So again, Paul Hoffman from Safran Technology, and Paul's been quite active in. Turn up the volume a little bit. So as we, just before we begin, say the kind of these formal questions, I'll just invite each of the panelists to just give a brief kind of description of the kind of work that they're doing and their interests in this symposium. So I'll begin with Paul, and then we'll go from Lean over. So Paul, just a brief kind of introduce yourself and the kind of work you're doing and how it's related to ontologies and big systems.
Okay, I'm Paul Hoffman, and I work for Safran Technologies. And before I worked for SAP, and that's also how I've met Mike, and I have been working in the field of semantics and machine learning for a while. And Safran Technologies is a company that has commercialized associative memories. Associative memories are a combination of statistics and semantics. And what we do is we actually generate graphs, but it is ontologies automatically from huge amounts of data because we believe, and I guess we'll talk more about that, that it's very hard to define in a practical way ontologies for big data systems.
Okay, thank you. Lean.
Good morning. My name is Lean Bouchard, and I have worked at Oak Ridge National Lab for about 12 years now, and in the scientific data group. And my introduction to ontologies was actually here at NIST, where I worked with Michael and Steve. It was my first project on the process specification language. It was in the manufacturing domain. I have continued working with ontologies on and off and semantic technologies as demanded by projects. Since we are all project-based, I have been participating in a number of scientific projects of interest to my lab, and each time I've tried to bring in not only the importance, but also the use of ontologies in those projects. And so in terms of the different scientific disciplines that I have worked with, that included Earth and environmental science data and ecology data, and this is the one that I'm mostly, that I've worked with the most. I've also done some work with biomedical ontologies, and recently I am returning to that arena with potential projects in biosurveillance, where we are going to apply ontologies for data mining. Thanks.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm George Strawn. I'm the director of the NITRD NCO. It's Networking and Information Technology Research and Development, which is an interagency program that coordinates the IT research of about 18 federal agencies right now. I've been at NSF for a number of years, and prior to that, I was a computer science professor at Iowa State. Since I'm a director, you know I push papers for a living rather than study technology, but as an old computer science professor, I have to have a technology fix every now and then, and semantic and ontology technologies have been providing me with that fix, and I appreciate your making room for an amateur on this panel for those reasons. I'll simply say that my colleagues and I look for opportunities to apply semantic technologies in the domain of either forwarding science or forwarding science administration. And we've seen several possibilities in both cases. Probably say a little bit more about that further on.
Good morning. My name is Olivier Bodenrider. I'm a researcher at the National Library of Medicine, which is part of the National Institutes of Health, one of the 27 institutes at NIH. And I'm researcher there. I do research in biomedical terminologies and ontologies, and basic research and research on the applications of terminologies and ontologies to data integration, to support for natural language processing and understanding, these kind of things. So I will be representing my work, but also the broader use of ontologies and terminologies in the biomedical domain, because as you know, the biomedical domain is fairly rich in terms of this kind of artifacts. And the field is really exciting these days with a number of initiatives, especially related to large systems that, of course, need ontologies or to some degree need ontologies to achieve their goals.
Okay, thank you. So we'll begin with the first question. Why are ontologies important to the success of your work? And so we'll go again, starting with Paul, and then kind of moving down the line. So Paul, can you give a few comments on why ontologies are important to the success of your work?
Yes. Ontologies are important because when we talk about big data, we talk to a big degree about text. And as we know, data is growing exponentially. It's following Moore's law, and it's doubling every 18 months. And text actually triples in this time span. And analyzing text, we always need some kind of a semantic to understand its meaning. And so if we want to analyze big data, we have to understand the meaning behind the text. And analyzing text is very important because one characteristic in my eyes of big data is that one is able to analyze structured data that traditionally or in the enterprise come from enterprise applications, from a business warehouse, from business intelligence, and then one tries to combine them with data from the web, and most of the data from the web is unstructured and doesn't have originally an ontology, at least as long as we don't have a semantic web. And then we try to combine those and reduce the risk, understand customer loyalty, understand what the customers are thinking about the product, how they interact in their network with their friends or peers, and what that means for a product. Or we are able to do data application, for instance. Think about the merger of United and Continental Airlines. And now they are faced with the situation that they have all their parts doubled. But the parts are not exactly the same. Some are exactly the same, and then it is easy. Some are similar and some look as if they are the same, and they are not because they don't have the same type of approval from federal agencies and so on. And part of this information is in a data warehouse, like I said, it is maybe structured data. And a lot of other information comes from what I would call the tribal knowledge, and it is text, it is notes, it is things that is stored in other types of system. And so one of the problems in big data analytics is to bring those two together and to make sense, and then to understand if things are the same or if they are similar. And in order to do this, one has to build some kind of an ontology. And there are different approaches, and I'm sure we'll hear of them, and we have heard of them. during this conference. And the approach of associative memories is basically to build a graph about the information on the fly, and to be able to annotate the data as it comes and learn automatically.
Okay, thank you. So again, what we'll be doing is kind of going through each of the kind of panel's responses to this question, and then we'll open it up to the entire symposium. People can ask the panelists maybe some follow-up questions. These six questions I have here are mainly just guides to help us along, but I really, if there's an interesting little topic, we'll follow that and we'll chase that and see where it goes. So again, we'll go through each of the panelists with this question and then open it up, because actually I have a few follow-up questions just even from Paul's comments. So Lynn.
So I work mainly almost exclusively with a scientist, and they consider themselves as the hard scientist, the physicist, and earth scientist, and chemists, and neutron scientist, and nuclear scientist, and material scientist, who are like, this is the thrust of my lab. And over the 12 years I've been there, all of these sciences have become not only big producers of data, but also more and more interdisciplinary. That is, it's no longer the era of the scientist, producing data and performing experiments by himself or herself in their own lab, and just publishing the paper. It has become much more interdisciplinary, and the teams also that are formed to respond to proposals and produce advancements are much bigger, and they're also with people from different kind of background. So you will have like computer scientists, information scientists, you will have people with a physics background who work in a chemistry environment, and a lot of it is also being done by computer simulations. So as opposed to a lot of experiments being done in the wet labs. So because of this situations, ontologies have become really key as a means of communication between all the different parties in a project. And this is actually a hard call to convince these scientists that they actually need that kind of tools, but after a while they realize that they cannot just because let's say if all the codes that they produce is actually done a lot of the time by graduate students or postdocs who move on, and if there is no way of understanding what has actually been done in those codes, there is a need for a communication and a need for a lot of what used to be implicit knowledge that would go not just in the data, but also in how this data is being produced needs to be encoded formally. And that's why the ontologies are important for this aspect. One particular example that I have worked with is in the earth and climate science, where models of the earth atmospheric and climate system is being produced and run on the big computers that we have at the lab and at other labs as well. And when there are new simulations that are being produced, which is every couple of years, there's new codes and that are coming out, and they have to the results of these codes, where they actually implement equations about various layers of the atmospheres, various flows and currents of around the that makes the Earth's entire climate systems have to be validated. That is, if there's a new piece of code and a new set of equations in that in those pieces of code, they have to validate that with actual observations. That is, with measurements that are being taken around the globe. By all kinds of sensors, and there's also measurements done by satellite. So in order to being able to validate these codes, there is a need for using the appropriate data, and in order to do these validations, you need to know what kind of data you're going to use in order to validate the code. And this is where the need for the ontology becomes crucial, because there's the description of all this data that is being used in the computations in order to validate it with the observations, that the ontologies would actually allow some kind of automation of that that part. That is, you can do the validation by looking at the codes and looking at the data, one set of one data set or a couple of data set at a time. But if you have this process automated with ontologies, then you can have really gains of efficiency for doing that kind of validation. And that's an integral part of the science process.
Thank you, Lynn. George.
So since both DOE and NIH are members of NITRD, whatever is of interest to them is of interest to us, and I would claim it. And of course, one of the things we attempt to do is provide a platform for the agencies to strut their stuff among themselves, and so best practices can be more readily and applications can be communicated among the various agencies. NIST, of course, is our host here, is also a member, as is NSF, as are a number of other agencies. From a science standpoint, the science application of our member agencies that I'm most familiar with is in Olivier's area, with his colleague Tom Reinflesch, creating Semantic Medline, which is a semanticized version of the extensive Medline database of titles and abstracts of biomedical research articles. I'll probably try to steal a little of Olivier's thunder and mention that from time to time, since I think it's an outstanding example of a system which combines semantic and ontology technologies with natural language processing and vocabulary development and utilization. And those seem to me to be three pretty important things once they're all put together. Using those concepts, as I mentioned before, we're also interested in science administration as well as the conduct of science itself. Two projects that we will eventually become involved in, they're gleams in people's eyes right now, I would say. Number one is called a dashboard of all the federal scientific investments in science, or in our case, in information technology science. For example, if we can get an abstract description of all of the funded projects, let's just talk grants for the simplest level, all the funded grants at NIH, at NSF, at all of the other agencies that fund information technology research, then we can provide semantic processing to understand which projects are really doing what, and prepare much more meaningful dashboards, that is, summaries with drill-down capabilities of exactly what the portfolio of the federal government's research in this area is. That's something that I'm sure will develop sometime, and I'm betting it will be based on ontology and semantic technologies as the only reasonable way to do it. It's awaiting a lot of vocabulary development and, for example, the extension of the NLP techniques developed at NLM to other scientific disciplines and the like. The other, many of you have probably heard of the OMB's project called data.gov. In fact, Jim Hendler and his crew up at RPI have taken it on themselves to semanticize a lot of that raw data, which has been put up by federal agencies. Recently, we're being asked to look at the creation of a research.data.gov community, which would, in some sense, attempt to regularize and make more useful scientific research data contributed by the agencies to this big data concept in the sky called data.gov. There's no doubt in my mind that ontologies and semantic technology will be crucial to at least to making a next generation data.gov, and so we're quite interested in that.
So just to follow up a little bit on what you were saying, the same technologies that my colleague Tom Reinflash has developed for extracting information, extracting relations from Medline, he's also applied to grants. And he contributed to develop a portfolio analysis toolkit, if you wish, that's used by other institute at the NIH. And of course, all this is grounded, because it's biomedical grants, all this is grounded in the Unified Medical Language System, the UMLS that's been developed at NLM for close to 25 years, which is a terminology integration system, super ontology, if you wish, or lightweight ontology, depending how you look at it, but a large ontology integration system. So that's one thing. Another point I wanted to make is that to some extent, all this is also related to, or can be related to, something that's coming up in June, which is the Health Data Initiative that's organized in DC by HHS and the former HHS CTO, who is now the US CTO, Todd Park. And so what they want to do is to expose the data of these federal agencies, and HHS in particular, for the Health Data Initiative. And this is done not only through ontologies, but also through providing data sets and providing, let's say, web services, APIs. And of course, the ontologies are behind the scenes in these APIs. You don't necessarily see them, but they are certainly present behind the scenes. But so, why do we need ontologies? I would just make three points, if you wish. What we want to do in biomedicine in particular, and more specifically in the context of electronic health records, is to reuse the data, to integrate data, and to mine the data. So I will just briefly go through these 3 points. We need to be able to reuse the data because for a very long time, clinical data has been collected by a given provider or by a given institution and confined to the environment of this provider and this institution. And of course, if it's and I'm not even talking about, you know, paper data versus electronic data. Let's assume that everything is electronic, which is not quite the case, but we're getting there, I guess. We need to share the data and reuse the data if we want to do things like pharmacovigilance. So if we want to be able to detect adverse events from the data that's in the electronic health records, we need to be able to reuse the data. There's also a lot of effort these days on comparative effectiveness research. How do I know that treatment A is better than treatment B? So traditionally, that has been assessed through randomized clinical trials, but that also can be supported by reusing the data that are collected for healthcare and for clinical documentation. And of course, also to mind comes population health research, so more the public health view on this, that could also be derived to some extent from the aggregation of clinical data. So in order to be reused or to be maximally useful in their reuse, data will need to be integrated. We need to be able to integrate data of the same kind across institutions, for example, electronic health records from institution A shared or aggregated with the electronic health records of other institutions. But we also need to be able to integrate data of different kinds. That is, for example, electronic health records data with the biomedical literature, if you want to be able to, and that was actually the example that was given in the communique, where based on a case, an agent would search the literature and scan, you know, new treatments or an association between a given symptom and the disease to help diagnosis. And of course, we also need to integrate with reference knowledge bases, because a lot of the data that's in the literature has been abstracted in knowledge bases. And so just to finish up with that, we need ontologies in all this, especially when we want to do data mining. And we need ontologies for two main reasons. First of all, when we reuse data, the level of granularity at which the data has been recorded is not necessarily the same as the level of granularity that's useful for mining. And most often it's recorded at a fine-grained level, and it needs to be abstracted away or generalized in order to be able to do effective mining or mining with enough statistical power. So we need ontologies for aggregation, but we need also ontologies as a shared vocabulary. I mean, without even talking subsumption reasoning or aggregation, we need to have a shared vocabulary, and that is what is being prescribed, if you wish, in the context of the meaningful use. You might have heard of this. So the meaningful use is a number of criteria that have been that have been proposed and for the certification of electronic health records. And in order to be able to exchange data effectively and to demonstrate compliance with meaningful use criteria, a number of vocabularies, terminologies, ontologies, depending how you look at this, have been prescribed for use. And for example, there's one for medications, there's one for diagnosis and diseases, etc. So we need a shared vocabulary, and we need to be able to aggregate.
Okay, thank you. So I'd just like to open up discussion then to everyone at the symposium, everyone physical here and on the chat, and ask the panelists kind of questions. Like I said, these six questions are just guidelines. If we only make it through one, but insights appear, that will be very worthwhile. So we'll begin the questions. Doug.
Okay. Two of you were mentioning midline use for ontologies, hooking them up with papers and things like that. I've noticed that various journals in different disciplines require data be published in some sort of machine-readable form. Some of them have required formats. For the midline, are you just using the ontologies to put keywords in, or are you suggesting or requiring or even seeing that statements encoded in ontologies are being associated with the papers?
Well, that's a very good question that has been debated for a while. So Medline is a database of bibliographic records created at NLM. And these bibliographic records are indexed by NLM indexers. We have about 100 contractors who basically scan the the full text of the paper and assign something between 12 to 15 keywords, if you wish, or descriptors, as we call them, from the medical subject headings vocabulary. So that's one thing, and that's not done by the authors, because we know it's difficult to do, and it takes somebody who knows mesh and who knows indexing to do that properly. That's one thing. What George and I were referring to is something completely different. It is a natural language processing system that is used to extract relations from the titles and abstracts of these 20 million records. So that's a different process. And this system doesn't use mesh only, it uses the full unified medical language system. So mesh is basically 26,000 descriptors, and in the UMLS we're talking about 2.6 million concepts these days. So it's much broader, and it has a larger structure, and it has other good properties. So what's been debated for a while is if we should do something like, or if authors should do something called sometimes micropublications, which is ontologizing, if you wish, a statement or an assertion from the conclusion section or something like this. And there have been attempts to doing this, but nothing has been completely successful to date.
Any other questions? Todd.
Lane, when you were talking, explaining what you were doing, you talked about code a lot. I assume that's software code?
Yes, this is actually how the scientists refer to their their codes are like thousands of lines, and it's usually of in Fortran.
For the models, right?
Yes.
So, the question I had regarding that in the data is: are you using ontology for the design of the software, or for the operation of the software, or both?
It's actually neither of those. The models that they refer to and these are really like sets of physical equations, and I'm using ontologies for the data discovery, for the type of data that is being published from these codes. And now we are like looking at new projects where we could use ontologies for indexing or for adding the metadata, if you'd like, from the moment these codes are being produced. But this is not where we are.
Is there any interest from the scientists who are generating the code in using ontologies to represent their models, other than in Fortran?
I think that's
a no.
It's getting. It's better than it was 10 years ago. It's getting there, but they typically tell me that you cannot represent in language the kind of complexity that they represent in mathematics.
I understand
I'm not saying that I agree with that statement, but that's,
I guess what I had in mind is if you're using the ontologies to help represent the data, and the data is being generated by these particular sets of software, the software represents some physical model, can you make a better connection between the actual data and the physical model and the physics that they are trying to represent by the use of ontologies? Have a cleaner connection.
You could make that connection, but they're not doing it now, and they're not necessarily open to doing that at this point.
Would you feel that if they did that, it would facilitate interdisciplinary interactions and possibilities?
Yes, certainly. It would certainly help in that, even like when they're thinking about the future generation, training the future generations of scientists, which is a huge problem in the U.S. There's this deficit of scientists, and the generation, which is our generation, that has all these models in their heads, they are realizing that they need to transmit that. So there's starting to be this interest.
Simon?
Just checking to make there's a delay between flicking the switch and actually turning on. But, a friend of mine recently completed and defended a dissertation where she looked at the difference in the behavior in applying metadata between information professionals, that is, people whose initial training was in information science, library science, and knowledge organization, and between the behavior of, I guess you'd say, biologists. I'm not sure if you'd say life sciences, because some of them were paleobiologists, so they're not their subjects weren't really alive, but there was a very distinct difference in the behavior between the two groups that, even with a small sample, showed up. And I was wondering if you had noticed, or if the whole panel had noticed or was able to tell whether it was going to be possible for discovery by other people, possibly 10 or 20 years down the road when it's time for meta-analysis or validating results that you'd been relying on, whether one set of metadata or metadata created by one group was more useful in finding, or looked like it was going to be more useful for finding for the right purpose than for the other, or whether it seemed that both groups were equally bad or equally good. And secondly, slightly more broadly, it's now been about almost a year since the National Science Foundation data management plan mandate actually went into effect. I think it was delayed till May or June or something. But there should have been enough submitted that it may be possible to tell by now if there's any obvious differences between that let you know what type of person or what background the person came from who actually prepared the data management plans, and whether the data management plans are telling you information enough to answer my first part of my question.
Well, the data management plan at NNSF, in my opinion, and I'm a little more remote from that than I was a couple years ago, is that it's the first step in the journey of 1,000 miles. And it's already been 10 years just to get as far as it has, so it's moving very slowly for financial and other reasons, as beyond to technical reasons as well. I think that it is beginning to be paid attention to. My rumors tell me that in at least one case there was an award that they wanted to consider, but they were unhappy with the data management plan and actually went back and said to the investigator, you got to do better on your data management plan. So that's a step in the right direction.
Yeah, I would like to emphasize what George said, in the sense that it's moving very slowly in that direction. However, I was not aware of a study done like you mentioned about the dissertation about the different type of behavior with metadata by different groups, whether it's like librarians and people from information science or people from the science background who produce the actual data. However, I have participated in a Data One project from NSF, and that's been going on for like more than 3 years now. And I can guarantee to you that in that project, the information science and the data production science, or the sciences that produce the data, work very much together. And in fact, they were the project. There was some group of a project was instrumental in bringing what is a data management plan in NSF, and it's very much a concerted effort. So this maybe you're like thinking, you know, far ahead, or expecting things to move a lot faster than they would, but there's definitely this. It's moving in the right direction.
Okay. Just as a quick credit to that, that the author of the dissertation was Holly White, who was working or was paid through partly on the Dryad project, which was like part of Data One. So.
Quick comment.
A quick comment, and then I had a question, but we can defer the question, which was designed to spur some discussion. The comment was, though, my observation of the grumbles and things I heard in response to Lynn's describing the codes and the models that her scientists are working on, which are, I have to assume, things like finite element models, you know, turbulence codes, combustion, who knows what. And I was surprised that some people were raising their eyebrows that when she asserted that mathematical, you know, differential equations are going to do a better job than semantic models at calculating those things. It's,
I don't necessarily subscribe to that. Okay, but
no,
this
no,
is
I'm,
what I'm being
agreeing that mathematical models, in the arithmetic sense, will always be better at calculating airflow over a wing or combustion in a cylinder engine. You know, something like that.
Currently.
I just can't imagine why you would ever want to use logic to try and figure out combustion or turbulence or something. It's just
natural language.
Well, no, natural language is more of a semantic issue. But I just, what provoked me, I guess, is I was wondering if there was a complete difference in perspective that some of us are assuming is understood or not.
Let me defend the model position.
What does that mean? A model position.
Well, from a mathematical perspective, mathematics is a language. You have symbols, you have relations among the symbols, and
right.
You have expectations in terms of interpretations.
Yep.
Okay? The goal of those symbols and that infrastructure is slightly different, shall we say. But
right.
It's still representing something. So if you build an airflow model, whether it's for the climate, whether it's for airflow over a wing or something else, that is still a representation of something that are part of your knowledge.
Sure.
That it doesn't conform to common logic or whatever. Implicit in it, though, are some of the basic same basic tenets as to causality, dependencies, and so on. So it's representing things in just a different domain. That's
right.
All.
And I think mathematics does a pretty good job of representing airflow and chemical kinetics and all kinds of things.
Well, don't talk about homology then.
All right. Anyway, my question, which I say I'll just put on the table out there, which was sort of a variant of number 5 there on the screen, it was more what I was curious what people's thoughts were with respect to not necessarily a killer app that they're using or developing, but what anyone is developing. I'm curious as to whether or not people think ontologies and semantics will hit the mainstream incrementally, or will it be something like, you know, Google gradually starting to introduce semantic search into their regular statistically based search things? I would just, because I've got my own opinions on that, I was just kind of curious what others, and Todd can't, he's about to jump out of his seat there, I think.
No, sorry, the panelists have priority here. So that's what we can do is maybe move on to that question. I mean, we don't have to address these in order. Steve, what do you think? Was it closer to question number 4, the exciting initiatives, or the killer app?
No, it was It was really the introduction of semantics and ontology into society, where people would recognize it as such.
Okay, so maybe we can just jump to that question. So then, Paul, we'll kind of skip up to question number five, sort of in that spirit. So what do you think is the kill rap in ontology and big systems that you're hoping to see emerge over the next few years?
I'm trying to mix up the panel a little bit. I think ontologies have failed in big data, and Google doesn't really use semantics. I mean, they could have used the graph to analyze the World Wide Web, but it wouldn't scale. They actually have tried, and you can read it in their publication, and it just wouldn't scale to do that. So they have gone for the next best, which was a very flat and inverted index. And you see this in Google search. You get very funny results, which look funny to the human who understands the meaning, but make a lot of sense if you just have an inverted index. And then another company, MetaWeb Freebase, they have actually experimented and commercially successfully applied ontologies, and they have something what I'd call a semantic URI. But there is a lot of handwork involved, and Google bought them at one point, and it's not an automatic way, and it would not scale. So in that sense, I see ontologies, and I talk out of some experience at SAP. I have done a couple of projects there where we used ontologies, for instance, to compose web services. So one of the big problems and in our internet economy is, of course, to come through with the promise of web services, to not have just very, very simple apps that we see now, for instance, on the App Store, and they all disjunct, and the world will be mosaics of little apps. We actually want to do complex things by putting those apps and web services together and talk to each other. And this could be one of the killer apps for semantics. And I see a possibility there, but my experience is, and we have a big community. We have a big community at SAP, and we talk to other companies like IBM and so on. And what turns out to be realistic is to build ontologies, to build a couple of them. As we know, the problem of federating them has not yet been solved, so we have to use what you maybe call dirty tricks or whatever, and bring them together. And one of them is statistics. And as you see with Watson, IBM Watson, it can be very successful to do that. Of course, they were not able to build an ontology for the property, but they were able to build ontologies for smaller things and then combine them in a statistical way, use a lot of approaches, ensemble approaches, actually, and then in the end vote. And the company I work for, Saffron Technology, has a very similar approach in the sense that we combine graphs with statistics. And then we can add significant, and it would help us, which kinds of graphs to combine. And so with statistics we can solve with rank ordering, we can solve the problem of significance and how to combine those ontologies. And we have been very successful in using that for big data applications. Like I have said in the intro, we can analyze huge amounts of data and find the underlying graph and find connections, find similarities, find co-occurrences, find classification, and especially find nonlinear classification. And I think this is every real-world problem is nonlinear. I have a PhD in physics, and all the real and interesting problems are nonlinear. And that is especially true also for in the semantic arena. And what do I mean by that? So let's say you analyze a customer set, or you analyze maintenance records, and then you have one criteria, and then you have all the values of your entities that you have analyzed in this class according to this one criteria. And then you want to rank order them, and you want to see which of those entities, for which of those entities this criteria is very relevant. And then you want to go on and you look at other criteria. You have a choice between 10, 20, or even more if you look for customer loyalty, for modeling customer loyalty, for instance. And then the high art here is to be able to find co-occurrences between those attributes, between those different attributes, and go around and find these co-occurrences. And this is what I call a nonlinear problem, because if you look at it from a statistical point of view, you would have to model it in a nonlinear way.
Okay, thank you, Paul. So we'll just kind of go down the line here, kind of addressing the killer app question.
Okay, I'll be brief on this one. I don't see any killer app emerging in the next 2 years. However, what I've seen is a lot of incremental progress and a lot of semantic technologies being used under the hood, or ontologies being used, even the word itself, even if it only describes a thesaurus or taxonomy, they now call it an ontology, and I think it's good for the whole field that we are here working in, and so that's progress for me.
Number one, I'd say the Watson stunt on Jeopardy is a good sign of awareness, a broader awareness of semantic technologies. Number two, I'd say Semantic Medline should be a killer app, but it's too new. And it's almost like going from the horse and carriage to the automobile. I don't think the old folks will ever be comfortable with it. It's going to be the grad students and the postdocs who figure they can make hay with this stuff and start displacing the older generation. As Olivier can tell you the details, there have been published articles based on Sparkle searches from Semantic Medline, connecting dots that the investigators hadn't been able to connect by themselves. We're going to do science via semantic technologies, already doing it, and when that becomes well understood, there are going to be a whole bunch of people jump on and pad their resumes with this type of activity. One last comment, a wish fulfillment. In federal administration, there's a lot of push for interagency, semanticizing interagency information, all the data.gov that I mentioned before. I think this is putting the cart before the horse, to get back to my horse and carriage metaphor, and that the thing we need to do is find a way to make semanticized information of great use to individual agency administrations and management. If all of the data in NSF, for example, can be put in an ontological, semanticized form so that new vistas for management can be seen by the NSF administration, they're going to invest more heavily in the technology, all the other agencies as well, and then we will trickle up to the broader interagency business. Obviously, we have to pay attention to incompatible ontologies along the way, but to get traction, I think we need to have a lot of focus on individual areas of responsibility.
So George just mentioned what's being done in the literature and how it can support what's called literature-based discovery, basically, which is a new field of research, if you wish. I'm going to go back to electronic health records because I think it's really encouraging what we see there also. So there's a push for adopting electronic health records in institutions. And it's not necessarily the institutions themselves that go towards electronic health records, but there's a mandate for that. And in the context of the meaningful use already mentioned, there's going to be incentives for health providers who can demonstrate that they meet the criteria for meaningful use. And all it ties to, very interestingly, is demonstrating quality of healthcare. It's not just for the sake of storing the data or even for being able to reuse them, but it's for demonstrating better healthcare. Also very interesting is the development of software platforms for electronic health records, and one that is distributed and that is adopted quite pervasively is I2B2, developed by Zach Kohani in Boston. And it's been adopted by many translational research agencies or groups. And what I find interesting here is that we are now seeing federation of these clinical research warehouses, if you wish, and through this mechanism, through the adoption of a common platform. And so the same people who developed I2B2, this software platform, also developed networks of these clinical data warehouses. And one is called SHRINE, standing for Shared Health Research Information Network. So we're really seeing the emergence of data integration in action, if you wish. And of course, all this is possible because of the ontologies in the background. When I say ontology, I'm not necessarily talking about formal ontologies or common logic in the background. Most often, it's essentially shared vocabulary and taxonomies, as we mentioned, so that we can do simple subsumption reasoning and aggregation of the data. So I don't see anything tremendously fancy or tremendously formal in this domain. And one last point I would like to make is that we're also seeing demonstrations that these things work. So they just don't work for the sake of integrating and for the sake of exchanging information, which in and of itself would be great already. But we have demonstrations, we have pilot projects showing that it is indeed possible to integrate health records with genomic data, for example. And one that I want to mention is the eMERGE network. Integration of electronic health medical records and genomic data, and they have it's a consortium of five institutions, including Vanderbilt and Mayo and the Marshfield Clinic. And what they've demonstrated over the past couple years is that by putting together the health records, although they weren't integrated in the first place, they weren't using I2B2 because it preceded basically I2B2, so they weren't using the same systems, but by pooling the data, they actually were able to study associations between genomic variation and phenotypes such as high blood pressure or other diseases, if you wish, with a greater statistical power than they would within each institution. So I think this is really encouraging, and we're going to see more of this kind of sharing across institution in the future, to the point that the electronic health records, the integrated electronic health records, will basically be the textbooks of the future, if you wish. That's where the information is going to be, and that's where the reference is going to be.
Okay. Thank you. So I just want to move on to the go back to the second question, because I think it kind of ties together some of the work that was done at last year's summit on.
Someone has a hand up on the chat.
Yeah, I just want to I want to kind of get through the next question on the, from the panel, and then I'll open it up for questions. So last year's summit on kind of making the case for ontologies and the business case, and one of the big kind of factors there was, you know, how do you actually evaluate success? And so in some sense, a killer app would be something that would be kind of a brand new thing that would be actually working. But I just want to kind of go through the panel now and ask the second question about you know, sharing different specific success metrics from the application of ontologies in your domain. So Paul, would you like to address that question?
I think we should differentiate here between success in a scientific sense and in a commercial one. I don't know a good answer. What comes to my mind is usage. If we see a lot of people using it, or if we see an application we couldn't have done before, that I would call success. But I guess I pass on this question.
Okay. Lynn.
Yeah, I don't have metrics in a scientific sense. I don't, you know, I don't have any kind of measurement to offer. But what I can offer are anecdotes of success stories. That in 2004, and Michael, you've heard that one before, that DOE had a series of workshops about data management, and and asking the scientists what their requirements were for better data management in the next 5 to 10 years. And at that point, you know, I mentioned ontologies, and a group of scientists actually left the meeting and said, no, we have no interest in that. We don't know what it is. What we want is fast transfer. And it was actually even spelled out in the preface of the workshop papers that came out afterwards, that somebody raising the word ontology was created a mutiny because they didn't want to deal with it. Well, so we're like 8 years down the road, and now you find a call, the word ontologies and the semantic technologies actually appears in the call for proposals, internal at my lab, as well as in other labs, as well as in the agencies. So for me, that's a definite success. Now it's even this is like very anecdotal. I don't have any measurements on that, but it's recognized as something that we need.
So we can promote semantic midline to associate professor after a certain number of publications have been achieved. I'm a little nervous about the whole metric subject because I see metrics as a characteristic of mature systems, and we're always dealing with immature systems in IT. And so it's hard to come up with what are the appropriate metrics when you're still trying to see the shape of the whole area. I would quote no less an authority than Albert Einstein, who reportedly said, not everything that can be counted counts, and not everything that counts can be counted.
Well, I think as much as I love ontologies and for having studied them for a long time, I think not everything should be seen through the lens of ontology. There's a danger to that. And some of the data sets that we have, including some of the very large data sets that we have in biomedicine, have little to do with ontology at all. When you look at gene sequences, for example, well, the sequence is what you need. And there have been algorithms defined to compare the sequences, contrast them, create phylogenetic trees and things like this. So we might need ontologies when we want to characterize the sequences or to link, I don't know, phenotypes to some of the variation. But these large data sets don't need much ontology at the first place. And I think one danger is in trying to ontologize everything or trying to impose ontology on everybody, and that's probably not needed.
Okay, so there was one question on the chat. Ravi, would you like to ask a question to the panel?
Yes, I would like to state the following. The metadata, and this is slightly off from this, but the killer apps should consider wrapping metadata at least into semantically correct metadata. We can debate and agree in future sessions what that envelope should be, because the pure metadata description of big data does not work. We are not able to find easy semantic integration of current metadata on data sets.
Okay. That was a comment, I guess. Okay. But I guess what I just want to maybe use a chair's prerogative on kind of another, maybe it's a little related to Ravi's question. Several of the panelists have kind of used phrases. I think Paul used the phrase, the role of unstructured data or ontologies with unstructured data, and George used the phrase semanticizing raw data. And Olivier's work kind of dealing with the kind of the Medline integrating with kind of natural language. So I just want to, this isn't a question here, but this kind of came up in the discussion. So I maybe ask the panelists again, starting with Paul. So do you see the role of unstructured data, the need to kind of add structure to the structured data, being kind of a bottleneck for the application of ontologies in big data?
Yes, I definitely see this as a bottleneck. If we are able to find ways to generate those ontologies automatically, and there are companies out to do that, your colleagues at University of Waterloo in Ontario, and they have a spin-off, and it's called Primal, and they are able to generate ontologies, simple ontologies, by looking at the corpus. So if we are able to make sense of this data, I'd say this is the killer app. And I personally believe we are for sure not able to do this in a closed way, that we build a big ontology like NASA has built this big ontology, and who is actually using it? And when we're done, the data has changed and there's more and more data generated. So there are a couple of approaches, like I mentioned before. So one of them is you build smaller ontologies and you bring them together with statistics. And my company is doing that, Saffron Technologies, and Watson has used this approach. Then there is the approach of Primal to generate the part of the ontology that you need, because the problem is you want to analyze hundreds of terabytes or petabytes. If you really go to the task in the way that you generate all those ontologies, as soon as you are done, you get another petabyte. And so what is if you understand more closely what the user looks for and just deal with it locally? And then the task is much more feasible.
Great. Lynn, do you want to address that question?
I don't see it as a particular. Could you actually repeat the question, maybe?
So do you see the unstructured data, the mass of unstructured data, and the applications that kind of rely on that being a barrier to the application of ontologies in big data?
No, I actually see that as an opportunity. And I think probably Olivier is much more in a position to talk about that, because that's exactly what he's trying to develop, so I'll defer to him.
Well, I'm never sure what people are implying when they say structured and unstructured, so I tend to say textual data and tabular data. so I know exactly what I'm talking about. So textual data, certainly at least one type of unstructured data. And as I mentioned before, I think we are on the verge of breakthroughs in natural language processing, as witnessed by Semantic Medline, the Watson stunt, and a few other things that I'm told are coming out of that community. So I think maybe it has been a bottleneck, but I think maybe that bottleneck is opening up a little bit. And, of course, the semantic technologies, even in their simple forms like Semantic Web, are working and available. That leaves to me the place where the bottleneck really is vocabulary development. 25 years to do UMLS. We don't want to take 25 years for every scientific discipline to do equivalently. I want to find a way to automate that so that we can move on and get rid of that potential bottleneck.
Oh, yeah, maybe just to rephrase that, because actually my question arose out of one of your phrases, semanticizing raw data. Okay, so maybe instead of unstructured, so maybe, Lynn, you could, if you want to readdress that, if you use the phrase raw data, because you have a lot of raw data, I suppose, from sensors, is that kind of the bottleneck? So.
Well, so there is really the raw data is actually, just set of numbers or pixels or things like that. And that's not really what I work with. I mean, I work with metadata, and then in that sense, it can be more or less structured. I mean, the more structured would be like an XML document, and then containing some maybe an abstract of an article.
Right, but the idea being that the effort required to add the metadata to the raw data, and then so the ontologies can work on those, is that what's going to be a kind of a barrier to adoption of ontologies? Because they need to work on the metadata, as you were observing.
Yeah, it is actually a problem. So now what we're working on, or what I've seen the developments are, like trying to provide systems that help the capture, the metadata, whenever it's being produced. And that has to be done automatically, and that's why capturing the parameters of a run, for instance, are as important as capturing what kind of data or the particulars of the variables and how they're calculated, because all this information, this like trace information, if you'd like, becomes part of the metadata, and you can extract the ontologies out of that.
Well, just to echo that, there's a big push for what's called provenance information, storing provenance as metadata along with the data at the source, and that's of course very important. Another point I wanted to make is that between the completely unstructured data or raw data and the annotated data, there's something that looks good, but is not necessarily that good. So there are a lot of databases where the data, look, fairly reasonably organized, but at the end of the day, it's not always clear what's in a column, for example. And we have examples of this in medicine. The few clinical databases that are shareable because they have been de-identified and they have been approved for being shared is the MIMIC database called out of Boston, and so it's fairly good if you wish, but at the end of the day it still is difficult to interpret the data because it's not specified very very tightly. There's a lot of textual data in electronic health records, and that is indeed a bottleneck, because before it can be exploited, information needs to be extracted from this. The VA, for example, has this problem because it has a large collection of clinical data. We're talking about 50 billion data points. And among these 50 billions, there are, the one lab test value, but there are also discharge summaries, pathology reports, radiology reports. And of course, before we can make sense of all this, information needs to be extracted from this. Interestingly, as part of the I2B2, so I2B2 is a grant from NIH that that was given for creating this structure for electronic health records. And as part of the I2B2 grant, Zach Kahani and his team actually created an NLP group or had an NLP component out of it. And this NLP component has organized challenges, and there's one organized this year again. So it's been going on for 5 years, I guess. And these NLP challenges are offered to the community to do things such as, well, here's a set of textual data from electronic health records. Tell me if the patient was a smoker, okay? So how do you extract smoking information out of textual data? Looks fairly simple, because first thing you would do is use, I don't know, regular expressions and things like this. Turns out that it's much more difficult than this, and it's enough to keep the community going for a while. So they've done smoking, they've done other such challenges, extracting medications and the reasons why they were prescribed, these kind of things. So just to summarize, it is indeed a bottleneck, and there's a lot of activity in the biomedical NLP community to address this bottleneck.
Okay. Thank you. So we ended up getting through about three of the six, but I think a lot of interesting discussion was raised. Do any of the panelists have any kind of closing comments that they didn't get to address? If not, there are two people who are really, really, really itching to make a comment. So we have just a couple of minutes. Todd.
I'll defer to my second one. And excuse me, had to do with the ability to create ontologies out of data and the reference to the 25 years to come up with a medical terminology. I want to ask, are there any specific items, elements, thingies, impediments that caused that delay? Was it people? Was it processes? Was it just lack of interest?
Okay, so it's not been 25 years for creating a terminology. So NLM doesn't create any terminology. NLM integrates terminologies. So the reality is that there have been many biomedical terminologies created, 160 integrated in the current version of the UMLS. But there are more than this, because we don't integrate everything that exists. And the NCBO Bioportal, NCBO being the National Center for Biomedical Ontology, the center Mark Musen runs in Stanford, integrates 250 ontologies these days, biomedical ontologies. So the reality is that these things keep being developed and keep evolving. So it's a never-ending job, if you wish. So ontology of drugs, there's a new drug created every morning or every week, certainly. So there are weekly releases of these drug vocabularies and ontologies. And the community needs to keep up with that. So it's not that it's taken us 25 years to come up with this. It's that it is an ongoing process. If you are, the integration is an ongoing process, because these terminologies do evolve and new ones get created for various reasons.
Well, then, a follow-on question: are the creators not recognizing previous work done, i.e., they're doing it just all by themselves from scratch?
So there are various models for creating terminologies and ontologies. And the reality is that new ones get created for various reasons, for various governance reasons, for reasons of public availability of other ones or not. So there are various reasons, but this is the reality that we need to deal with, basically.
It's a better reality than many other scientific disciplines that haven't even put their shoulders to the wheel yet.
So one last quick
question. Jeff, I think Atlanta's right. It's going to be incremental in terms of, killer apps. And obviously the first step is they're taking a bunch of unstructured, making a structure, or text to tabular, depending how you look at it. A lot of people are doing that. Watson and one of our sponsors, Franz Inc., is doing that also with medical stuff. and then tracing that back, symptoms and all that kind of thing. Second thing is, this is kind of, here at NIST, I've ran into two people that are exactly on our wavelength. There was a woman here for R&D genomics, and she was saying, well, I was told her I was here for ontology conference. She says, yeah, that's what we're getting into. So people within the disciplines of each discipline are going to not become ontologists, but at least be knowledgeable about it. And so that points to the 2 years ago, I was here for a conference, and I ran into a scientist in the lunchroom, and he said he didn't want to become an ontologist. He had all this knowledge, so they just brought in a PhD student. So this is another problem that we're going to have. We have to transfer that knowledge before it's gone. So I think it's incremental. I think they're going to come up with a killer app soon, but it'll probably be 2-3 years once people become trained within each discipline.
Okay. Well, I'd like to thank all of our panelists. We're kind of running out of, we're a little over time. Sorry, Ravi. We want to kind of keep the break here. We have the demos afterwards. But so I'd just like to thank the panelists, Paul, Lynn, George, and Olivier, for generating a lot of great discussion. And Paul, thank you very much for getting up very early in Palo Alto to join us.
Thank you, Mike, for inviting me. Thank you.
And
great discussion. Thank you.
And Paul, if you have just a couple of espressos, you can kind of stay online and watch the demos now that you're up. So
I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, so we'll take a break now until 11 o'clock, so about 25 minutes, and we'll have the demo session. Peter.
I have an announcement to the remote people. The first demo in the afternoon, maybe Michael, if you refresh the page. The first demo after the break actually will be delivered through both the voice line and a GoToMeeting shared screen that's by courtesy of the EDM Council and Mike Bennett. So thanks, Mike. However, you need to register at GoToMeeting, get a webinar ID, and download the client. The process
how
is automatic.
How do we get that link, Peter?
Yeah, the process is automatic, but it'll take a couple of minutes. So this is a great time to do it during the break.
Click on this here, right?
Right. Click on there. It's
on
the chat.
Is it on the web page?
It's on the chat. It's on the chat, and the chat sends you to the web page that says it.
Can you see on the VNC?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll enjoy the coffee provided by Corey, and reconvene at 11 o'clock.
I actually think the killer app has been brought up, which is going to come in the internet of things, because ontology is going to be most useful in machine-to-machine communication, not human. And it's when machines are going to need to self-announce and self-describe. They'll do that by means of an I was jotting down an example. Let's say you were told,
Yes, I was pleased to see you managed to stick it in the webinar. I tested the link. I clicked on the thing and it came through to